Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do racially homogenous communities differ from their more diverse counterparts? And what is the appeal of leaving integrated neighborhoods for places where everybody looks the same? Many Americans report being concerned about security and longing for old-fashioned neighborhood experiences. And for a small but growing subset of European Americans, the solution seems to be picking up and moving to remote but thriving communities populated almost exclusively by other white people. So what are these communities like? What sort of people choose to live in them? And what effect might they have on U.S. culture as a whole? Rich Benjamin is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank Demos. He spent 2 years living in these white boom towns and has written a book called Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Rich, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
The term whitetopia is obviously a fusion of the words white and utopia. How exactly do you define a whitetopian community?
A whitetopian community has three qualities. The first is that it has posted at least 6% population growth since the year 2000. The second is the majority of that growth has to have come from white migrants. And the third is that it has to have an ineffable charm, a pleasant social look and a feel.
And that's the part that's hardest to define in some ways, but you sort of know one when you see one, is that it?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It bears pointing out, given the subject matter, that you, in fact, are African-American. But you've written that you're not especially interested in the sort of standard explorations of the black-white divide in America. Will you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. I think that the black-white divide bores me utterly. And what irritates me is on the East Coast, people focus that on and on. But people in Texas and California and New Mexico tend to realize that race relations is also brown-white, black-brown. And so that's how I look at our country's future. One of the crucial information animating this book is that by 2042, white people will no longer be the American majority.
Can you talk about who lives in whitetopias?
Yes. Whitetopia is a mix of singles, young families with young children, and retirees.
It's interesting because you find that retirees and families with young children have different needs, but in some ways sort of the same concerns.
Yes. When I spoke to folks in Whitetopia over my travels, what I noticed is that Whitetopia tends to draw people at two pivotal moments in life. When a resident is young, i.e. has young children, or when a resident is retiring, because that's when the nostalgia kicks up. You remember how your own childhood is, but also young people and old people require security in their life, emotional security and literal physical security. So that's part of the lure of Whitetopia.
Yeah, let's talk about that security for a moment, because people seem to, regardless of the reasons they gave for living there now, people seem to universally in these places talk about how they felt safer where they lived today.
Yes, yes, yes. And safety is defined many ways. It's defined socially. It's defined against crime. And so that was a word I kept hearing over and over again, is safety.
Do you think that's code for saying I only feel safe among white people?
Sometimes, not always. Sometimes I took it at face value and safety meant safety. But other times, and it was very concrete, it wasn't even code, is in St. George, Utah, for example, I sat in on an active local group called the Citizens Council for Illegal Immigration. And one of the themes in Whitetopian community is that Latino gang violence is on a rise. Because of global networks, Latinos are funneling violence and crime throughout the U.S. in a way that we didn't see 20 years ago. And so oftentimes, yes, violence is coded racially.
You write about the fact that as more people find virtual workplaces appealing, they're also increasingly longing for what they see as real communities. And yet, as you mentioned when you talked about elderly people sort of being nostalgic for their childhood, I wonder if they're not remembering an America that never existed in exactly the form that they seem to try to recapture.
I wonder myself, and I think the answer is Yes, they are imagining an American that never existed, because 1950s America had all sorts of gangs, youth gangs. It had domestic violence. And so it's not the safe, idyllic place that many people imagined it was.
Now, these Whitopias tend to be pretty religiously homogenized, a lot of Christians. Interestingly, though, I found this fascinating, they are not exclusively inhabited by political conservatives.
Yes, they are not. CNN, I found this recently after the book published, released its 2009 list of best places to live. And the top best place to live in America, according to CNN, is Louisville, Colorado. And Louisville, Colorado sits in Boulder, Colorado, which overwhelmingly went for Obama 70% to 29% over McCain. And so not all Whitopias are conservative, but I did crunch the numbers, and the majority of Whitopias are politically conservative.
You call the people who live in these refugees from diversity, but it is significant, I think, that a sizable percentage of them don't list sort of avoiding minorities among their top 10 reasons for moving.
Yes, they don't. And the reason I say that, pardon me?
Yes. Go ahead.
The reason I say that is because, first of all, they're not surveys in every instance of why folks moved. I did a lot of research. I had a lot of conversations, and indeed, most people, as you point out, do not at all say people of color set me going to Whitopia. But often, what I find is that the neighborhood qualities that they do value, safety, comfort, higher property values, as Americans, these are subconsciously associated in our minds with whiteness. That when we do find neighborhoods with these qualities, we just assume that they're white.
Talk for a minute about your research process, because I suppose you could have come up with the demographic trend from your office in New York City, but you went and moved into these places.
I did, and I'm so glad I did. After having come up with the data, I embedded myself in three Whitopias for 3.5 to 4 months each, the first being St. George, Utah, the second being Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and the third being Forsyth County, Georgia.
And how did you go about making yourself a member of the community?
That was the fun part. I socialized. I went to church. I went to political meetings. I'd go to the county Republican meeting. I'd go to the Citizen Council Against Illegal Immigration meeting. I'd go to the gun clubs, I'd hunt, I'd fish. One of my favorite parts of St. George, Utah, for example, was I developed a poker crew, or rather I joined an existing poker crew, and we'd play poker twice a week at Texas Hold'em, and it was a $10 buy-in.
So I hear this, and I think another interesting thing about the book is that you found yourself on a personal level really connecting with some of these people whose views and worldviews, I should say, differed so much from yours. Did that present a sense of conflict for you?
No, I don't think so. I think that the connection helped the research. And in a way, while I'm doing the research, it doesn't matter what my worldview is because I'm trying to learn about someone else's.
And you presented yourself, you told them that you were a writer and that you were doing a book about race, but you didn't use the term Whitopia when you would get to know these people.
No, I did not.
Yeah. Can you talk about why?
Well, because I didn't want them to have any preconceived notions about the research I was doing. And so I just chose not to present what the title of the book is. Because I'll give you a concrete reason. If I call your community a utopia, but you don't feel it's a utopia, does that bias your idea? In other words, if you want to report negative things about your community, then I saw no point in sharing that title.
Did you get the sense ever that you were sort of a novelty to these people?
Yes and no. In Idaho, I suppose I often was a novelty. In Forsyth County, Georgia, I'm so not a novelty. Forsyth County, Georgia is near Atlanta. It's an hour north of Atlanta. And Atlanta is teeming with black folks, as you well know.
What did you feel your blackness in a different way when you were in, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho? If that question even makes sense to you.
It's a brilliant question. It makes total sense. And I did not. But I did feel my class in a different way.
Yeah. And you found that class was, in some ways, equally something that equally sort of divides people.
Yes. Even in a homogenous white community, class shows its face and can divide people.
Were you nervous at all before you moved into these places about what you might find there?
I was apprehensive, not nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't nervous for my physical safety. I wasn't nervous about whether I wouldn't have a good time or things like that. But I was apprehensive.
You tell a sort of funny story in the book. You used a real estate agent in these places to sort of begin to scout out properties as if you were going to buy a $1 million home. And you made some assumptions about your real estate agent.
Yes. Well, I lined up an appointment with a realtor in St. George, Utah. And let me quickly say that in my head, the best, most thorough way to learn about a community is to go through a realtor because they understand a community in all its glory and warts. So I just figured I'd pose as a home buyer and pretend to buy a home and just see what I would find without any preconceived notion. So I set up this appointment from Manhattan. We traded tons of emails. We had one phone conversation. So here I show up in St. George, Utah for my first home search, and the realtor is also black. And I call this black. I'm black surprise. So in the book, we call it black surprise.
And
on both ends. She's surprised I'm black. I'm surprised she's black.
Yeah, and this is, an experience that you had both had many times in the past, that people didn't know your race and assumed you were white, and then you show up and you're not.
Yeah, her voice sounds like Kelly Ripa, I have to say.
Where do you think you fit in terms of when you were partying with these people, essentially, how did you get yourself invited back? You started first, right, by inviting the neighbors over?
Yes. Or, I'd meet someone in an Episcopal church service. Hi, I'm new to the community. Introduce myself. They introduce themselves. You find some points of common ground. They say, okay, come over for dinner, or else they come over for dinner. And we get invited back because, at least from my head, I can't speak for them, I found the conversations interesting and I found the people valuable. And so I have to say the one invitation I did decline is when Derek and Lisa, who have 6 and 8 year old daughters, they invited me to go rodeo. And I couldn't bear the thought of being out rodeoed by a 6 and 8 year old. And I was terrified of humiliation. So that was the one social invitation I declined over 2 years.
On the other hand, you became quite a fan of golf.
I did. And now I'm still playing.
You had not played before you went through all this?
No, I had not.
Mm-hmm. And were there things about the experience of playing the game that you didn't imagine ahead of time?
Yes, as a writer. Hmm. Because as a writer, your back and your spine stiffen. They stoop. You spend 10 hours a day in front of a computer. Golf liberates your back.
Rich Benjamin is my guest. He's a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank Demos. His new book is called Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to be part of it. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rich Benjamin, who is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank Demos. His new book is called Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Kyle in Fort Worth emails to ask if you would elaborate on what you touched on in regard to class division in the communities and what you experienced.
Well, for me, one of the most poignant comments I would hear in Whitetopia is that folks who had grown up there and who are fourth-generation natives were worried and concerned that they could not raise their kids in the very communities they grew up in because of the influx of new money. And that happened in Idaho, it happens in Oregon, and it even happens in Utah. So that's an example of class. And another quick example I'd like to point out is in one afternoon I saw the stark class divides. I had befriended a friend, fellow called Ed, and this is in North Idaho. And after 2 weeks, I'm like, where do you live? And he revealed to me that he was living out of a rented storage unit because he couldn't afford so much as an apartment. Well, that very afternoon, I went to a quote-unquote meet and greet for United States Senator Mike Crapo, a Republican from Idaho, at the lavish estate of cattle barons. And so it's that stark, in some cases, the class span or the class divide in Whitetopia.
Whitetopia, in addition to being very, very white, is very, very straight. What did you make of the fact that you met so few gays and lesbians there?
That didn't surprise me, that I would meet so few, because there tends to be a conservative social aura. In other words, the homogeneity is like a snowball effect. And that's one of the problems, I think, about the whole phenomenon of segregation, is that it reinforces extreme points of view, because every psychological and political study shows that when you surround yourself with like-minded people and then you don't hear intelligent opposing viewpoints, then your own viewpoints calcify, and hence the extremism.
Why do you think this phenomenon, at least from having read your book, appears to be unique to white people? Why are there not communities of people who are moving out to be around other black people and other Latinos and other Asians?
Well, when, first of all, one thing the book does never do is to sort of criticize white people for leaving cities, because as your question implies, people of all races can get fed up with the city and leave. More often than not, however, when black and Latino folks leave cities, they tend to flee to integrated suburbs.
Why do you think, what's the difference between people who would stay where they are and people who pick up and move to Whitetopia? Was there anything you could identify that sort of said, okay, yes, this is a Whitetopia person and this person can sort of stick it out in a more diverse community?
I wouldn't put a personal psychological profile on it. In other words, I wouldn't say this person is more likely to have X, Y, Z personality traits. But I would put a sociological profile on it in saying that this person, more likely than not, is to oppose immigration. This person, again, because of the point in their life, is to want security. This person is more inclined to like private resources, i.e. private schools, private parks, private gated communities. So this person, I would put a lifestyle index on it as opposed to peg the personality.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Sam who asks, if President Obama asked you to advise him on how to bridge the racial divide in the future, what would be your advice?
I would give very concrete policy advice. We are about to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on our infrastructure in America. That means our roads, our highways, our bridges, and our broadband access and the like. We should not make the same mistake we made in 1950 when we built highways and we built communities. We essentially gave a very overt preference to white suburbanites, and we're still dealing with the ramifications of that. And so I would spend this public policy money very carefully, to build integrated communities. So when you look at an Atlanta or when you look at a Dallas or a Houston, you ask yourself, why isn't there public transportation? Why, for all these years, have we prioritized highway spending and not public transportation spending? And in the case of Atlanta, I have not lived in Dallas and I have not lived in Houston. People say, quite frankly, in the Whitetopia north of Atlanta, we don't want public transportation going up from Atlanta because it changes the, quote, profile of our community, which is code word for race. And so my concrete advice to Obama would be build wisely and don't ask the taxpayers to subsidize segregation.
What differentiates the current phenomenon from white flight that happened after school integration?
It's a good question. I assume you mean the white flight that happened in the 1970s, mm-hmm. after the federal government came in and said, we're going to integrate public schools and public parks. Then there was a band of white flight.
Right.
This one is more subtle. It's more lifestyle oriented. It speaks to what we spoke about, how Americans are indifferent to what their offices look like. They're open to virtual offices, but they're very particular about how our homes and how our communities look. So one, this new brand of white flight is more lifestyle oriented. It's more insistent on natural resources and amenities, beautiful parks, beautiful walking trails. And the third quality is it's politically savvy. I mean, we hear, and we can talk about this later, what these migrants think about taxes, what they think about health care reform, what they think about immigration reform. So I think it's not to say that back in the day people didn't read newspapers and weren't politically aware. My sense is that this version of white flight is way more consumer and politically savvy.
Well, you know, you write about this issue of incidental racism, which is the fact that, for example, people who would never use racist language and probably don't even think of themselves as feeling superior as whites are sort of pleased that when they get to the public school in their Whitetopian community, they don't even have to think about whether there will be kids of other races there.
Yes, exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Wichita Falls and speak with Whitney. Hey, Whitney.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I wanted your guest to comment a little bit about the socioeconomic factor. I live in and have lived in mostly rural or rural adjacent towns, you know, largely middle class in Texas. And I taught in a town of about 5,000 that was pretty 50-50 Hispanic and white. And I found that the students' behavior, their way of dressing, their attitudes towards education seemed to be a little more towards the socioeconomic line, really, than the racial line. Not to say that race doesn't play a part, but it seemed more of a poor versus rich kind of thing. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Well, it's a good question. When that question is asked, I'm also left to wonder, therefore, would you want to segregate poorer whites from wealthier whites? In other words, if you were to say a certain set of behaviors belong to poorer whites, and you can make the stereotypes, the trailer park, the crystal meth, does that still become a good reason for not integrating them? So I can't comment intelligently as to whether classes have different cultures. That's not my expertise. What I would say is that even if it is a class difference, and you could say poor whites behave this way, poor Latinos behave this way, I'm not sure what the implications are.
Now, you grew up in and around D.C., is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and mostly in overwhelmingly white neighborhoods.
Yes.
What was that experience like for you?
Well, I wasn't a big fan of it, frankly. I haven't been asked that before. It was, you know, I made great friends. I had a good education, but I probably wouldn't choose to raise my kids that way.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you write a little bit about this in the book. People sort of looked at you as different. You were accepted in the community, but you never fully felt like you fit with everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's totally fair.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Rich Benjamin is my guest. The book is called Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. What did it take for you to come home after you went out and lived in these places and among these people to make sense of your personal experience vis-a-vis the data that you had already collected?
Pardon me, I didn't hear the question.
How did you come home and sort of unpack your personal experience and use that to tell the story that would sort of illustrate all of the numbers that you had and the trend that you were documenting?
For me personally, it's easier to unpack and tease out and crunch the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But to make sense of a personal experience is from also the more fun and the more challenging part of it. And you just sit down and you review and you think in utter silence. I work in utter silence. I turn off my phone, I turn off my computer, and I systematically and thoroughly unpack all the interviews I gave. I've kept a journal, and then I begin to organize it.
You write about the fact that you spent some time with people who had a lot of association with the Aryan Nation.
Yes. This was in North Idaho. Christian Identity is a church religious arm of Aryan Nations, and they happened to have a three-day retreat while I was in North Idaho, so I figured I'd crash it and see what they were about.
That seems to me, and you say that you never had anxiety, but it seems to me like that would be a little bit frightening.
Well, I joked with my sister that I didn't wear any loafers that day in case I needed to run. So I had some nice Adidas track shoes on.
How did they respond when you walked in?
They were surprised. They were baffled. I'm the only non-Aryan journalist to have done that. And they walked up to me and said, "What is the black man doing on our compound?" And I explained what I'm doing on their compound. And one of the surprising things, though, is I was not greeted by naked violence or hostility. It was more curiosity and debate.
Did you have the sense that they thought of you as someone who was different than other black people?
That could be, but they never said so.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to take any of them and shake them by the shoulders and say, what is up with your beliefs?
No, I didn't.
Really?
No. I didn't, because I absorbed their beliefs, and it kind of, I'm sort of resigned to it. In other words, I'd heard that there's this Aryan Nation presence in North Idaho, so A, it's not my job to question their beliefs, but B, that's sort of useless, because they've been there, and debate is kind of pointless.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Michael in Sunset. Hello, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Listen, I just turned the radio on. I was listening to the comments, and I'm actually up here in North Texas visiting from the Atlanta metro area.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in one of those white enclaves up north of Atlanta. There's Roswell, Marietta, Sandy Springs, and such. And, you know, what the speaker mentioned a little while ago about the fact that the people in these areas don't want to change the profile of their neighborhoods. Not being a native there, I'm sort of outside, but the standing comment I've heard is that people are more interested in not giving open transportation to the criminal activity and the crime rate that's prevalent in Atlanta.
Does that sound like something that you heard elsewhere? Thanks so much for your call, Michael.
Thank you.
What do you think about that, Rich?
I have heard that comment. And the flip side of that comment is, how do you open up the Atlanta economy? In other words, if you want to hire from Atlanta, or you have young people from these communities who want to work in Atlanta who are not of driving age, what do they do? So it's interesting. There are all sorts of reasons why you would want public transportation in that area. For example, Europeans I know who move to that area think it's kind of daft that if they don't have a driver's license, they can't go to the opera, they can't go to the theater in Atlanta. And so to say we're not going to build public transportation because we don't want crime coming up, if that's not a racial code, I don't know what is. What about the other benefits to the transportation system, i.e. circulating labor, circulating employees, the opera, the theater, the culture.
Are the crime rates in Whitopia, when compared with cities of similar size that are more integrated, significantly lower?
I have not done that research. It would be fascinating, though, to compare, let's say, Maplewood, New Jersey, which is an integrated community up with high property values, great public schools, and great facilities. It would be interesting to compare their crime rates to St. George, Utah's.
It sounds like the people in St. George, Utah, if nothing else, believe that their crime rate is lower.
They certainly do. They certainly do.
Let's go next on the phone to Teresa in Dallas. Hey, Teresa.
Hi. I had a question for Rich. I just wondered, I haven't heard the whole conversation, but did he do any research on kind of integrated families? Like, I know of, you know, more and more, a lot of more affluent white Americans go, say, to Africa to adopt children and bring them over here and raise them in a white community. And kind of what are the ramifications on that, and how do those kids get along?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
No, I haven't done that.
On the other hand, your family, your personal family situation has people from every corner of the world, it sounds like.
From most or many corners mm-hmm. of the world, yes. Mm-hmm. And that sort of informs my research. What does it mean to have a family? If we take a family as a microcosm of a nation, what does it mean to have a family that spreads so many nations? However, I never say in the book that that makes this better or that makes it ideal. It's just a point of comparison.
Mm-hmm. Rich Benjamin is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank Demos. We're talking about his new book this hour. It's called Searching for Whitopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Rich Benjamin is my guest. He's a senior fellow at Demos. His new book is called Searching for Whitopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Rich, what message do you think it sends to kids growing up in Whitopia about the nature of the world?
I think it would be a skewed nature of the world. I think that when you grow up in a homogenous neighborhood surrounded by a more plural country, you do grow up with a skewed nation of the world.
Do you imagine these kids will go back to live in these places where they were raised after college?
I imagine some won't even leave these places. And I do, yes, imagine that some will go back to live there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Britt in Little Elm. Hey, Britt.
Oh, hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi.
Hello, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, so I welcome your book with interest, but coming from Europe, you know, the race, the diversity of race as a writer, I've been to many countries, including Somalia and Russia, and I find that now we have a wonderful president of honesty and integrity, that this should have been bringing the people of the USA together. It should have been a together as we the people. And I think this is a message that President Obama is trying to bring to us, that, you know, God made us different. Yes, he did. But he made us different, not to hate, but to love. And so, you know, white diversity should be a non-issue. It's we, the people, and it comes from the cradle. And so it has to start in a school to make children understand that they are exactly the same. We all bleed.
Thank you
so much. We all cry.
Britt, thank you so much.
I'm a Jew, so we come from horrible backgrounds. So we have to live with the past. But you know, the future is wonderful. And if we could just look at it and share the dreams of people who support Obama and people who support the country in general and the success of it. You see, I don't look at Obama as a Republican, nor do I look at him as a liberal. I look at him as a man trying to save the country, and I admire his courage.
Britt, thank you so much for your call. You made some great points, and I want to give Rich a chance to respond to that. I know that President Obama himself has said one president can't change all that is troubling America with regard to race.
I agree. I think this is our issue. It's the people's issue. It's the issue of local governments. It's the issue of state governments. And yes, federal policy has a role to play. And Obama himself has pointed out that one candidacy, one administration, perhaps two administrations, aren't the point. It's going to require sustained effort, because this book really looks at the long haul. It does look at 2042, when white people will no longer be the American majority. And what fascinates me is Texas has already reached that point. So has New Mexico. So has Hawaii and California. So we have four states in our nation that have already reached that.
Did you have the sense in any case that the people who were moving to these Whitetopias were in fact bracing themselves for 2042?
Yes, even if they don't know the statistic itself. And I say that because when we hear the town hall rallies against immigration reform, when we hear the birther movement that asks if our president is a citizen, when we see signs of Obama with a caption reading undocumented worker, i.e. implying that he's undocumented worker and he is biased towards undocumented workers, when we hear Congressman Joe Wilson cry out to the president, "You lie, our tax dollars are going against for illegal aliens' health care," I think that there is an existential crisis in conservative white America where all these issues are coming to a boil: taxes, health care, public spending, immigration. And when we hear, literally I heard this, "We're going to take our country back," my question then becomes, take it back from what? And so I do think that there is a fear of the future underlying all this.
Let's go next on the phone to Alan, where we'll speak with Constanza. Hi, Constanza.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, I was wondering if there's any intercultural groups, like there's interfaith groups, in which Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Zoroastrian, you know, all of the different religions get together and exchange, and they go and visit each other's a place of worship. I was wondering if there's any intercultural in which people go and visit Chinese, Vietnamese, Blacks, Whites, Hispanics, different ethnic groups, but like an intercultural exchange, if he knows of any. And I just want to make a comment that I try to do that in my life every day. I try to go to different religious groups, and I also try to see myself with everyone, with Black people, Chinese people, Indians, and participate in their events and their festivities. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Did you see anything like that?
Did I?
In Whitetopia?
I was not made aware of any intercultural groups, and I do feel I researched the gamut of groups and options and networking meetings and political meetings available.
And you write about the fact that these people in these communities were okay with a cultural dance or a foreign food restaurant or something, but only if it didn't really threaten the sort of balance of cultural power within their area.
Yes. I do write that, and I do believe that.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Emily in Dallas. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I was wondering, as a journalist, did you only observe or did you interact with the communities?
I interacted quite a bit, socially and politically.
Are you still in contact with any of these folks?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Were you concerned about what they would think when they opened up the book and read about your perception of where they live and how they live?
No, I can't be concerned. And I can't be concerned also of what my mother thinks. Yeah, because my mother, she'll harass me and say, well, what are you going to say? What are you going to write? And I don't show her advanced drafts of the book, only my editor. And so I'm not concerned what my mother thinks. I am not concerned what the community thinks.
Might be a wise policy, I guess, for any author in process. Let's go next to Dallas, and we'll speak with Art. Hi, Art.
Yes, yes, yes. I just wanted to mention in 1970, I was in third grade, and my teacher mentioned that a requirement to be president was you had to be white, and the only exception on the Catholic was Kennedy. And I thought quite a bit about it with Obama becoming president, which is a milestone. Another one was I do listen to the radio. I'll flick around to hear Rush Limbaugh and just his take on a lot of stuff, and it's got a lot of people, you know, again, like he said earlier, about taking back our country. And there's a lot of people that will hold on to that idea and not let go of it, which it's damaging. That's the main thing I want to point out, is that it's damaging. We all have to get along. We all have to share this country. I'm Hispanic, by the way, and I basically want to mention that.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Did you meet a lot of Limbaugh listeners, Rich?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. And I pointed that out in my book. There's one fellow, he's a roofer in Utah, which means he spends a lot of time in his pickup truck going from appointment to appointment. And he's a Rush Limbaugh fan, and he told me all of Rush Limbaugh. And he happens to be a delightful person. When you're not talking about politics, he's one of these person who the mere sight of him lifts your mood. But then you start talking about politics. And an interesting thing there is, at that point, Utah and the people I met were convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to be the Democratic nominee and the U.S. president. And they said, oh, my God, Hillary's going to socialize medicine. We're screwed. We're going to Australia. And I heard that in all seriousness.
Hmm. So I can imagine that they were equally disappointed with the election of President Obama.
Yes. The point being, no matter who won the presidency, there was a prearranged script that healthcare reform is socialized medicine.
Let's go next to Barbara in Richardson. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. I was raised in Cincinnati in a suburb. I'm white. I was raised in an all-white suburb. I think we had a boy who was from Samoa, but he kind of came in and came and went out. When I went to college, I was really upset with my parents why they didn't, you know, give me any more extensive view of what actually the world is like. I met lots of people from different countries, different colors, different, you know, races. And now I live in Richardson. Richardson is very integrated. And the school system is still quite good. My parents, their excuse was they wanted to give us the best education we could get. But, you know, in Richardson, there's at least in my kids' school, there is no one group that's the majority. There's just many, many minorities. And it's high caliber. So I don't think that's, I know that's a big excuse that white people give, is they're not trying to get away from other people. They're just trying to get the best education. So if the schools are good enough, I don't think that's a valid point.
Thanks so much for your call. Did you hear a lot about schools and education?
I really appreciate her bringing that up, because that's a running theme, is that in Whitetopia, I meet extremely decent, extremely friendly people who merely say, we want the best for our kids, and they associate subconsciously integration with poor life quality in poor public schools. But that's, Richardson is one example where you can have your cake and eat it too. Integration, good quality public schools, and I can cite many other examples.
So talk for a minute, Rich, about why, if these pockets of sort of self-identifying Whitetopia lovers exist, how that touches the rest of the country and why it's not good for any of us, in your view.
I think that in the short term, segregation appears to alleviate social tension. But in the long term, when we have 2042, as the country grows more diverse, it's disastrous. I think it's disastrous to accept balkanization as a de facto part of an American life. And I think a democracy functions at its optimum when all people in all social groups are integrated as full and equal members.
Do you actually think we're in danger of balkanization?
Yes, 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 yes. If we don't take the proper precautions, absolutely. I mean, now our country looks a certain way. What does it look like in 2042? And we already see interesting tensions that aren't obvious or immediately apparent. For example, the baby boomers are predominantly white. That's the graying of America. However, young people are predominantly brown, kids under five, let's say. So this graying of America, this browning of America, does it present even spending clashes? And I heard older Whitetopians who are retiring saying, you know, I'm fed up of having to pay for public education. I'm fed up for having to pay for the social services that go to immigrants, legal and illegal. And so this chasm between brown youth and older white folks is played out in Southern California. I'm sure you see it in Texas. It plays out in New Mexico and so on. And so, yes, the short answer to your question is, I think balkanization is a legitimate concern.
And you actually also found that, people who live in these many of these Whitetopian communities don't sort of recognize the amount of benefits that they receive from, tax dollars and, federal distribution of funds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To give you an example, there are a couple immigrant-rich, diverse states like California, New York, and New Jersey that give more to Uncle Sam than they receive in federal benefits. And the reverse is true in a couple of predominantly white monoculture states like Montana and Wyoming. So it's often the case where diverse states that sometimes are on the coast are giving more to the federal government per capita than they're receiving in return. So this idea that, you know, big cities and multicultural states are mooches off the federal treasury just isn't true.
Will you ever go back to Whitetopia?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
What will you do when you go?
Well, I'm sort of, how should I say, not negotiating, but we're debating how to arrange a book reading. I'm mulling over an invitation from a couple book clubs there. So if only to talk about this book, that alone could bring me back to Whitetopia.
Could be a fascinating discussion, too.
I think so.
Rich Benjamin is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank Demos. His new book is called Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Rich, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.